Rosaline's philosophy, Surikov's geopolitics, and Putin's civilization expressed in a few words. The Night Wolves found concise ways to translate sexual anxiety into geopolitics and back again. As a male-only club devoted to black leather, the Night Wolves naturally had a strong position on homosexuality, which they defined as an attack by Europe and the United States. A year later, celebrating the Russian invasion, their supreme leader Alexander Zadostanov remembered their proud parade around Crimea in this way. "For the first time, we showed resistance to the global Satanism, the growing savagery of Western Europe, the rush to consumerism that denies all spirituality, the destruction of traditional values, all this homosexual talk, this American democracy." According to Zadostanov, the slogan of the Russian war against Ukraine should be "Death to faggots." The association of democracy with gay Satan was a way to make law and reform foreign and unthinkable. Having invaded Ukraine, Russian leaders took the position that their neighbor was not a sovereign state. This was the language of empire. On March 4th, Putin explained that Ukraine's problem had been democratic elections that led to changes in power. Such functional elections, he suggested, were an alien American implant. He said that the situation in Ukraine was like that of Russia during the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. Russia could go back in time and correct the mistakes of the past. Logically, said Alexander Dugin on March 8th, Ukraine as it was during 23 years of its history has ceased to exist. Russian international lawyers, who during those previous 23 years had paid obsessive attention to the need to respect territorial boundaries and state sovereignty, argued that invasion and annexation were justified by the disappearance of the Ukrainian state. In other words, by the chaos caused by the Russian invasion. In Dugin's mind, the war to demolish the Ukrainian state was a war against the European Union. We must take over and destroy Europe. On March 16th, some of the Ukrainian citizens of Crimea took part in an electoral farce that the Russian occupiers called a referendum. Prior to the vote, all public propaganda pushed in the same direction. Posters proclaimed that the choice was between Russia and Nazism. Voters had no access to international or Ukrainian media. On the ballots were two options, both of which affirmed the annexation of Crimea by Russia. The first option was to vote for the annexation of Crimea by Russia. The second was to restore the autonomy of the Crimean authorities, who had just been installed by Russia and requested annexation by Russia. According to internal information of the Russian presidential administration, the turnout was about 30%, and the vote split between the two options. According to the official results, participation was about 90%, with almost all voters choosing the variant that led most directly to annexation. In Sevastopol, official turnout was 123%. Qualified observers were absent, although Moscow did invite a few European politicians of the extreme right to endorse the official results. The Front National sent Aymeric Chopard to Crimea, and Marine Le Pen personally endorsed the results. Within the Russian presidential administration, people were reminded to thank the French. In a grand ceremony in Moscow, Putin accepted what he called the wishes of the Crimean people and extended the boundaries of the Russian Federation. This violated basic consensual principles of international law, the United Nations Charter, every treaty signed between independent Ukraine and independent Russia, as well as a number of assurances that Russia had offered Ukraine about the protection of its frontiers. One of these was the Budapest Memorandum of 1994, in which the Russian Federation, along with the United Kingdom and the United States, had guaranteed Ukrainian borders when Ukraine agreed to give up all nuclear weapons. In what was perhaps the greatest act of nuclear disarmament in history, Ukraine handed over some 1,300 intercontinental ballistic missiles. By invading a country that had engaged in complete nuclear disarmament, Russia offered the world the lesson that nuclear arms should be pursued. In March and April, Russian media conveyed the propaganda themes that had been discussed by the presidential administration and the Izborsk Club in February. There was a burst of enthusiasm for the federalization of Ukraine, on the logic that the voluntary separation of Crimea required Kyiv to give its other regions similar freedom of action. the Russian Foreign Ministry was careful to specify that federalization meant a specific Russian proposal to dismember the Ukrainian state, not any general principle that might apply to Russia. On March 17th, the Russian Foreign Ministry declared that in view of the deep crisis of the Ukrainian state, Russia had the right to define Ukraine as a multinational people and propose a new federal constitution for the country. The word federalization appeared in major Russian television media 1,412 times in April. Even in a mood of national euphoria, however, Russian leaders soon saw the risk of federalization. The name of the Russian state was the Russian Federation, and it was divided into units, but these had limited legal meaning and were ruled by appointees of the president. Within 3 months, the word federalization all but disappeared from the Russian public sphere. Vladimir Putin presented the annexation of Crimea as a mystical personal transformation, an exultant passage into eternity. Crimea had to be part of Russia, explained Putin, because the leader of ancient Rus, Volodymyr Valdemar, whom Putin called Vladimir, had been baptized there 1,000 years before. That act by his namesake was recalled by Putin as the powerful gesture of a timeless superhero who predetermined the overall basis of the culture, civilization, and human values that unite the peoples of Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus, concepts that did not exist at the time. If the events of our time are predetermined by a millennial myth, then no knowledge of the past is necessary, and no human choices matter. Vladimir is Volodymyr, and Russia is Rus, and politics is the eternal pleasure of the wealthy few, and there is nothing more to be said or done. The parliamentary deputy Tatiana Sayenko cited Ilin to claim that the annexation of Crimea meant the resurrection and rebirth of Russia. She claimed that Western objections to the Russian invasion of Ukraine were a matter of double standards. This common Russian argument made of law not a general principle, but a cultural artifact located among non-Russian peoples. Because Western states do not always follow every law, it ran, law had no validity. Russia, too, might violate laws, but since Russia did not accept the rule of law, this was not hypocritical. Since Russia was not hypocritical, it was innocent. If there are no standards, went the reasoning, then there are no double standards. If Europeans or Americans mention international law during a time of such Russian innocence as the invasion of Ukraine, this makes them a spiritual threat. And so references to international law only demonstrated Western perfidy. This was Ilin's politics of eternity. A cycle back to the past replaces the forward movement of time. Law means what Russia's leader says it means. Russia is repairing God's failed world with violence. Putin was the redeemer from beyond history who emerged to alter time. Putin himself took up this theme on April 17th, characterizing the Russian invasion of Ukraine as a spiritual defense against a permanent Western attack. The intention to split Russia and Ukraine, to separate what is essentially a single nation in many ways, has been an issue of international politics for centuries. For Malofeyev, the Russian invasion was a war against eternal evil. For those who do battle there, the war looks like a war against hordes, fighting under the banner of the Antichrist with satanic slogans. What could be more eternal than the campaign against Sodom? The fall of Crimea encouraged Russian leaders to repeat the same scenario throughout southern and eastern Ukraine. On March 1st, Glazyov telephoned confederates in the regional capitals of Ukraine's southern and southeastern districts to help plan coup d'etat. Putin's Eurasia advisor ordered that the scenario of Crimea be repeated in other regions of Ukraine. A crowd would storm the regional state administration building, then some new assembly would be coerced to declare independence and ask for Russian help. In Kharkiv, a crowd of locals and Russian citizens, brought by bus from Russia, did indeed break into the regional state administration building, after first storming the opera house by mistake. These people beat and humiliated Ukrainian citizens who were seeking to protect the building. The Ukrainian writer Serhiy Zhadan refused to kneel and had his skull broken. In April, Putin publicly recited the goals of Russian policy as outlined in the February memorandum. The idea was still the disintegration of the Ukrainian state in the interests of Russia. Dozens of Ukrainian state institutions and companies suddenly faced cyber attacks, as did the most important institutions of the EU. In the southeastern Ukrainian district of Donetsk, a Russian neo-Nazi named Pavel Gubarov proclaimed himself People's Governor on May 1st on the logic that Ukraine never existed. The duo of Malofeyev employees sent to Crimea, Igor Girkin and Alexander Borodai, returned to Ukraine in April. Borodai would name himself Prime Minister of an imagined new People's Republic in southeastern Ukraine. His justification was similar. There is no longer any Ukraine. His friend Girkin proclaimed himself the Minister of War and asked Russia to invade the Donbas and establish military bases. The Russian intervention in the Donbas was called the Russian Spring. It was certainly springtime for Russian fascism. On March 7, 2014, Alexander Dugin rejoiced in the expansion of liberational, from Americans, ideology into Europe. It is the goal of full Eurasianism, Europe from Lisbon to Vladivostok. The fascist commonwealth was coming into view, boasted the fascist. A few days later, Dugin proclaimed that history had been undone. Modernity was always essentially wrong, and we are now at the terminal point of modernity. For those who rendered modernity and their own destiny synonymous, or who let that occur unconsciously, this will mean the end. The coming struggle would mean real liberation from the open society and its beneficiaries. According to Dugin, an American diplomat of Jewish origin was a dirty pig, and a Ukrainian politician of Jewish origin a ghoul and a bastard. Chaos in Ukraine was the work of Mossad. In the same spirit, Alexander Prokhanov, speaking with Evelina Zakhamskaya on Russian television on March 24th, blamed Ukrainian Jews for Russia's invasion of Ukraine and for the Holocaust. This was a new variety of fascism, which could be called schizofascism. Actual fascists calling their opponents fascists, blaming the Holocaust on the Jews, treating the Second World War as an argument for more violence. It was a natural next step in a Russian politics of eternity, in which Russia was innocent, and thus no Russian could ever be a fascist. During the Second World War, Soviet propaganda identified the enemy as the fascists. According to Soviet ideology, fascism arose from capitalism. During the war against Nazi Germany, Russians could imagine that Soviet victory was part of a larger historical shift in which capitalism would disappear and all men would become brothers. After the war, Stalin celebrated a national triumph, not so much of the Soviet Union as of Russia. This suggested that the fascist enemy was the outsider rather than the capitalist, and thus a more permanent conflict. In the 1970s, Stalin's heir, Brezhnev, located the meaning of Soviet and Russian history in the victory of the Red Army in the Second World War. In so doing, Brezhnev definitively changed the sense of the word fascism. It no longer suggested a stage of capitalism that might be overcome, since history was no longer expected to bring change. Fascism meant the eternal threat from the West, of which the Second World War was an example. Thus, Russians educated in the 1970s, including the leaders and war propagandists of the 2010s, were instructed that fascist meant anti-Russian. In the Russian language, it is practically a grammatical error to imagine that a Russian could be a fascist. In contemporary Russian discourse, it is easier for an actual Russian fascist to call a non-fascist a fascist than it is for a non-fascist to call a Russian fascist a fascist. Thus, a fascist like Dugin could celebrate the victory of fascism in fascist language while condemning as fascist his opponents. Ukrainians defending their country were junta mercenaries from the ranks of the Ukrainian swine fascists. Similarly, a fascist like Prokhanov could describe fascism as a physical substance that spilled in from the West to threaten Russian virginity. In June, Prokhanov wrote of fascism as black sperm that threatened the golden goddesses of Eurasia. His lapidary expression of racial and sexual anxiety was a perfect fascist text. Glazyov also followed the schizofascist protocol. While endorsing Nazi geopolitics, he set a standard for calling Russia's enemies fascist. Writing in September 2014 for the Izborsk Club, Glazyov called Ukraine a fascist state with all the signs of fascism known to science. Schizofascism was one of many contradictions on display in spring 2014. According to Russian propaganda, Ukrainian society was full of nationalists, but not a nation. The Ukrainian state was repressive, but did not exist. Russians were forced to speak Ukrainian, though there was no such language. Glazyov overcame contradiction by invoking the West. The Americans, he averred, wanted a third world war because of high national debt. Ukraine should have collapsed when Glazyov made a few phone calls. When it did not, this only showed that his government was an American projection, the Nazi junta that the Americans had installed in Kiev. To defeat what he characterized as an American occupation, Glazyov maintained that it was necessary to terminate all its driving forces, the American ruling elite, European bureaucracy, and Ukrainian Nazis. The first one is the main aspect, the two others secondary. Putin's Eurasia advisor was saying that Eurasia required the destruction of American politics. The war for Ukraine and Europe would be won, Glazyov thought, in Washington. Like his advisor Glazyov, Putin defined Ukrainians who resisted Russian invasion as fascists. Speaking of the chaos that Russia had brought about by invading its neighbor, Putin claimed on March 18th that nationalists, neo-Nazis, Russophobes, and anti-Semites executed this coup. They continue to set the tone to this day. This claim had a certain schizofascist ring. Russian foreign policy in 2014 bore more than a passing resemblance to certain of the more notorious moments of the 1930s. The replacement of laws, borders, and states with innocence, righteousness, and great spaces was fascist geopolitics. Foreign Minister Lavrov's foreign policy concept, invoked to justify the invasion of Ukraine, repeated the principle that a state might intervene to protect anyone that it defines as a member of its own culture. This was the argument that Hitler had used in annexing Austria, partitioning Czechoslovakia, and invading Poland in 1938 and 1939, and the argument Stalin had used when invading Poland in 1939 and annexing Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania in 1940. On March 14, 2014, when a Ukrainian was killed by Russians in Donetsk, Lavrov claimed this as a justification for Russian intervention in a neighboring sovereign state. Russia is aware of its responsibility for the lives of its compatriots and nationals in Ukraine and reserves the right to defend those people. Putin said the same on April 17th. The essential issue is how to ensure the legitimate rights and interests of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers in the southeast of Ukraine. The fact that Ukrainian citizens enjoyed greater rights of expression than Russian citizens went unmentioned. Putin later promised to use the entire arsenal of available means to protect Russia's compatriots. This language of compatriots in what Putin called the Russian world made citizens of Ukraine hostage to the whims of a foreign ruler. A person disappears into a notional community defined from a great distance in the capital of another country. In the rhetoric of a Russian civilization or Russian world, Ukrainian citizens lost their individuality and became a collective whose culture, as defined by Russians, justified a Russian invasion of Ukraine. The individual disappears into eternity. In a war that was supposed to be against fascism, many of Russia's allies were fascists. American white supremacist Richard Spencer, Matthew Heimbach, and David Duke celebrated Putin and defended his war, and Russia repaid them by using an approximation of the Confederate battle flag as the emblem of its occupied territories in southeastern Ukraine. The European far right also applauded Russia's war. The Polish fascist Konrad Rękas endorsed Putin's Eurasia concept in general and the Russian invasion of Ukraine in particular. In September 2013, he anticipated that Russia would invade Ukraine and dreamed of leading a Russian-backed government in Poland. Robert Lucznia was a one-time collaborator with the Polish Communist Secret Police and a financial supporter of Antoni Macierewicz, a major figure in the Polish right. Together with Rękas, he tried to spread the Russian propaganda line that Ukraine was dominated by Jews. The leader of the Hungarian fascist party, Jobbik, invited by Dugin to Moscow, praised Eurasia. The leader of Bulgaria's fascist party launched an electoral campaign in Moscow. The neo-Nazis of Greece's Golden Dawn praised Russia for defending Ukraine from the ravens of international usury, by which they meant the Jewish international conspiracy. The Italian Fronte Nazionale lauded Putin's courageous position against the powerful gay lobby. America's leading white supremacist, Richard Spencer, tried but failed to organize a meeting of the European far right in Budapest. Among the invitees were Dugin and the German neo-Nazi Manuel Ochsenreiter, a defender of the Russian invasion of Ukraine on Russian media. A few dozen French far-right activists came to fight in Ukraine on the Russian side. They were screened by the Russian army and then sent into the field. About 100 German citizens also came to fight in the company of the Russian army and Russian paramilitaries, as did citizens of a number of other European countries. Russia's war in Ukraine created training grounds for terrorism. In fall 2016, a Serbian nationalist was arrested for planning an armed coup in Montenegro. He had fought on the Russian side in Ukraine and said that he had been recruited for the plot by Russian nationalists. In January 2017, Swedish Nazis, trained by Russian paramilitaries in Russia, bombed an asylum center for refugees in Gothenburg. In 2014, institutions and individuals close to the Kremlin organized Russia's fascist friends. In April 2014, a branch of the Rodina Party founded a World National Conservative Movement. It cited Ilin in referring to the EU as part of the global cabal, in other words, the international Jewish conspiracy. Alexander Usovsky, a Belarusian citizen and the author of the book God Save Stalin, Tsar of the USSR Joseph the Great, helped Malofeyev coordinate the actions of European fascists. Usovsky paid Poles who were willing to stage anti-Ukrainian protests at the moment when Ukraine was invaded by Russia. Malofeyev personally invited the leaders of the European far right to a palace in Vienna on May 31, 2014. At this gathering, France was represented by Émeric Chauprade and Marion Maréchal Le Pen, the niece of Marine Le Pen. Dugin stole the show with his passionate case that only a united far right could save Europe from gay Satan. The schizofascist lies displace the events in Ukraine and the experiences of Ukrainians. Under the weight of all of the contradictory concepts and hallucinatory visions of spring 2014, who would see or remember the individual on the Maidan, with his or her facts and passions, his or her desire to be in history and make history? Russians, Europeans, and Americans were meant to forget the students who were beaten on a cold November night because they wanted the future, and the mothers and fathers and grandparents and veterans and workers who then came to the streets in defense of our children, and the lawyers and consultants who found themselves throwing Molotov cocktails, the hundreds of thousands of people who broke themselves away from television and internet and who journeyed to Kiev to put their bodies at risk, the Ukrainian citizens who were not thinking of Russia or geopolitics or ideology, but of the next generation, the young historian of the Holocaust, the sole supporter of his family, who went back to the Maidan during the sniper massacre to rescue a wounded man, or the university lecturer who took a sniper's bullet to the skull that day. One can record that these people were not fascists or Nazis or members of a gay international conspiracy or Jewish international conspiracy or gay Nazi-Jewish international conspiracy, as Russian propaganda suggested to various target audiences. One can mark the fictions and contradictions. This is not enough. These utterances were not logical arguments or factual assessments, but a calculated effort to undo logic and factuality. Once the intellectual moorings were loosed, It was easy for Russians and Europeans and Americans to latch on to well-funded narratives provided by television. But it was impossible to work one's way towards an understanding of people in their own setting, to grasp where they were coming from, what they thought they were doing, what sort of future they imagined for themselves. Ukrainians who began by defending a European future found themselves, once the propaganda and the violence began, fighting for a sense that there could be a past, a present, and a future. The Maidan began as Ukrainian citizens sought to find a solution for Ukrainian problems. It ended with Ukrainians trying to remind Europeans and Americans that moments of high emotion require sober thought. Distant observers jumped at the shadows of the story, only to tumble into a void darker than ignorance. It was tempting, amidst the whirl of Russian accusations in 2014, to make some kind of compromise, as many Europeans and Americans did, and accept the Russian claim that the Maidan was a right-wing coup. The coup in the story of the Ukrainian Revolution took place earlier and in Russia, in 2011 and 2012, when Putin returned to the office of president with a parliamentary majority in violation of the laws of his own country. The leader who came to power by such means had to divert attention, blame, and responsibility to external enemies. For Putin, the Russian invasion of Ukraine was the latest episode of Russian self-defense from a Europe whose sin was its existence. The Russian claim of a coup in Ukraine was among the most cynical of the Kremlin's formulations, since the very Russians who made it had expected Yanukovych to be removed by force, and organized failed or successful coup d'etat in 9 Ukrainian districts. The issue in Ukraine was the weakness of the rule of law and the associated inequality of wealth and ubiquity of corruption. It was obvious to protesting Ukrainians that the rule of law was the only way to distribute resources collected by oligarchs more equitably through the society and to allow others to succeed in the economy. Throughout the entire period of the Maidan, social advance in predictable and just conditions was the central goal. The first protesters, in November 2013, were concerned with improving the rule of law by the Europeanization of Ukraine. Those who followed were concerned with protecting the rule of law, such as it was, from a corrupt oligarchical leader who had fallen under the sway of Moscow. In January and February 2014, protesters used the language of human rights. There were certainly representatives of right-wing and indeed extreme-right groups on the Maidan, and they were important in the Maidan's self-defense when the government began to torture and kill. The right-wing party Svoboda, however, lost much of its support during the Maidan. Right Sector, a new group, could only put about 300 people on the Maidan. New right-wing groups came to the surface after Russia invaded Ukraine, fighting the Russian army and separatists in the east. On balance, though, the extraordinary thing was how little the war swung popular opinion towards radical nationalism, far less than in the invading country. The far right did not begin the movement on the Maidan, were never anything like a majority, and did not decide how power changed hands at the end. Although, of course, different people took different views, the protests were generally supported by the largest Jewish communities of Ukraine, in Kiev and Dnipro. Among those who organized self-defense battalions on the Maidan was a veteran of the Israel Defense Forces, who would remember that his men in Kiev called him brother. The first 2 mortal casualties on the Maidan, in January, were the ethnic Armenian Sergei Nihoyan and the Belarusian citizen Mikhail Zhizhnevsky. Those killed in the sniper massacre of February represented the diversity of Ukraine and of the protest. Among them was Yevhen Kotlyov, a Russian-speaking environmentalist from Kharkiv, in the extreme northeast of Ukraine. 3 unarmed Ukrainian Jews were killed in the massacre, one of them a Red Army veteran. People of Ukrainian, Russian, Belarusian, Armenian, Polish, and Jewish cultures died in a revolution in the name of Europe that was started by a multilingual young man from a Muslim refugee family. A coup involves the military or the police, or some combination of the two. The Ukrainian military stayed in its barracks, and the riot police fought the protesters to the very end. Even when President Yanukovych fled, no one from the military, police, or power ministries sought to take power, as would have been the case during a coup. Yanukovych's flight to Russia placed Ukrainian citizens and lawmakers in an unusual situation. A head of state, during an invasion of his country, sought permanent refuge in the invading country. This was a situation without legal precedent. The agent of transition was a legally elected parliament. The acting president and the members of the provisional government, far from being right-wing Ukrainian nationalists, were generally Russian speakers from eastern Ukraine. The speaker of parliament, chosen to act as president, was a Baptist minister from southeastern Ukraine. The ministries of defense, internal affairs, and state security were taken over during the transition period by Russian speakers. The acting minister of defense was of Roma origin. The minister of internal affairs was half Armenian and half Russian by birth. Of the two deputy prime ministers, one was Jewish. The regional governor of Dnipropetrovsk, a southeastern region threatened by Russian invasion, was also Jewish. Although three of the 18 cabinet positions of the provisional government of spring 2014 were held by the Nationalist Svoboda Party, this was not a government of the right in any meaningful sense. People who carry out coups do not call for a reduction in power of the executive branch, but that is what happened in Ukraine. People who carry out coups do not call elections in order to cede power, but this is what happened in Ukraine. The presidential elections, held on May 25, 2014, were won by Petro Poroshenko, a centrist Russian speaker from southern Ukraine, who is best known as a chocolatier. If there was anything like a coup attempt at that moment, it was Russia's attempt to hack Ukraine's Central Election Commission in order to proclaim that a far-right politician had won, and the announcement on Russian television that he had done so. In May 2014, two far-right politicians presented themselves as candidates for the Ukrainian presidency. Each of them received less than 1% of the vote. Both of them received fewer votes than a Jewish candidate running on a Jewish platform. The victor Poroshenko then called for parliamentary elections, which were held in September. Again, this is the opposite of what would have been expected during a coup, and again the popularity of the far right in Ukraine was very limited. Neither of Ukraine's right-wing parties, Svoboda and a new one that grew from the paramilitary group Right Sector, cleared the 5% threshold required for participation in parliament. Svoboda lost its three ministerial portfolios, and the new government was formed without the right. The speaker of the new parliament was Jewish. He later became prime minister. The association agreement with Europe was signed in June 2014. It went into force in September 2017. History went on. It makes a difference whether young people go to the streets to defend a future or arrive in tanks to suppress one. For many Ukrainians, the future could not come fast enough. If the Maidan was possible, then political nations, civil societies, economies of gift, and individual sacrifice were possible, and might appear again. Since Ukrainian civil society had defended itself and the Ukrainian state persisted, Ukrainian political history continued. Because Ukraine did not fall apart with the first blow, the Russian politicians of eternity had to keep coming. The Russian officers sent to command the war in Crimea, and then in other parts of Ukraine, were people who inhabited a timescape of eternal Russian innocence. According to Borodai, Ukraine and Russia belonged to a common civilization, which he described as a giant Russian world that was formed over a millennium. The existence of a Ukrainian state was thus conceived as a form of aggression against Russia, since outsiders want to remove Ukraine from our Russian world. Borodai read Gumilov and worked for Malofeyev. Similar ideas, though, were held by Russians and Ukrainians who did not read fascist thinkers or work for sodomy-obsessed investment bankers. The Russian invasion of Ukraine coincided with a spike in popularity of the literature of the accidental time traveler, a Russian genre of science fiction. In these stories, individuals, groups, weapons, and armies loop back and forth through time in order to correct the overall picture. As in the politics of eternity, facts and continuities disappear, replaced by jumps from point to point. At the crucial junctures, an innocent Russia is always repelling a sinful West. Thus, Stalin contacts Putin to help him declare martial law in Russia and war on the United States. Or, Russians travel back to 1941 to help the Soviet Union defeat the German invasion. It became official Russian policy, as it had been official Soviet policy, to recall the Second World War as having begun in 1941 rather than 1939. The year 1941 is a moment of Russian innocence only if it is forgotten that the Soviet Union had begun the war in 1939 as Germany's ally, and that between 1939 and 1941 had undertaken policies in occupied lands that were not so very different from Germany's own. As recently as 2010, Putin had been willing to speak to the Polish Prime Minister about the Katyn massacre, the most notorious Soviet crime of the period. By 2014, this attitude had been completely reversed. Putin incorrectly defended the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939 as merely a non-aggression agreement, which was a throwback to Soviet tradition. If the Soviet Union did not want to fight, as Putin said in 2014, then why had the Soviet army invaded Poland in 1939 and taken Polish officers prisoner, and why had the Soviet secret police murdered thousands of them at Katyn in 1940? In 2014, Russian law made it a criminal act to suggest that the Soviet Union had invaded Poland, occupied the Baltic states, or committed war crimes between 1939 and 1941. The Russian Supreme Court later confirmed that a Russian citizen could be convicted of a crime for a reposting of elementary facts about Russian history on social media. The axiom of perfect Russian innocence permitted endless Russian imagination. Igor Girkin, who collaborated with Borodai in Crimea and in the subsequent Russian intervention in southeastern Ukraine, was also an inveterate traveler through timescapes. Though an officer of Russian military intelligence and an employee of Malofeyev, he found time to write science fiction for children. Before the invasion of Ukraine, Girkin was also a reenactor, someone who likes to dress up in uniforms and act out the battles of the past. In Ukraine, Girkin commented on a real war on a blog devoted to antiques. As an aficionado of the First World War and the Russian Civil War, he hoped to decorate the Russian soldiers of 2014 with medals from that epoch. As someone who reenacted the Second World War as a Red officer, Girkin cited orders given by Stalin in 1941 when he executed actual people during the actual Russian invasion of 2014. For many young Russian men, the intervention in Ukraine took place in an imagined 1941, amidst the remembered glory of their great-grandfather's defense of the USSR from Nazi Germany. Television enforced this perspective by its constant invocation of terms associated with the Great Fatherland War. Pervy Kanal used the phrase punitive operations in reference to Ukrainian soldiers more than 500 times. A reference to German actions during the Second World War, this phrase set the calendar back to 1941 and cast the Ukrainians as the Nazis. Russian soldiers in Crimea, when asked about their actions, changed the subject to the Second World War. After subsequent interventions in southeastern Ukraine, Russians made their prisoners of war march in public, imitating the humiliation parades of German soldiers Stalin had organized. Ukrainian citizens who chose to fight on the Russian side stole a World War II-era tank from a monument. Its motor was in working order because it had been repaired for a parade the previous year. One such partisan said that she could not imagine a Ukrainian victory, which would mean 1942. So long as battle was raging, it was always and forever 1941. During a major incursion in summer 2014, young Russians painted the words "For Stalin" on their tanks. In Russia, Stalin's, not Putin's, Stalin's approval rating rose to 52%, the highest recorded figure. The approval rating of Leonid Brezhnev also reached a historical high. It was long-dead Brezhnev who had created the cult of even longer-dead Stalin as the leader who had rescued Russia in the Great Fatherland War. Stalin and Brezhnev not only grew in popularity among the living, but also in resonance in their world. As time passed, ever more Russians expressed an opinion about their dead leaders. Stalin and Brezhnev were not receding into the past, but cycling back into the eternal present. Indeed, the simple fact that Russians in the second decade of the 21st century responded to regular political surveys about leaders from the 20th was strongly suggestive. The politics of eternity has more than a whiff of the undead. The war in Ukraine was not a contest of historical memories. Rather, the Russian invasion broke what had been a common Soviet myth about a common Russian and Ukrainian past. The name of the official war museum in Kiev was changed from Great Fatherland War to Second World War when captured Russian tanks from the war of 2014 were placed on its lawn. The Russian war against Ukraine was something more profound, a campaign of eternity against novelty. Must any attempt at novelty be met with the cliché of force and the force of cliché? Or was it possible, along with the Ukrainians of the Maidan, to make something new? Chapter 5. Truth or Lies, 2015. He who is deceived is turned into a thing. Mikhail Bakhtin, 1943. Black milk of daybreak, we drink in the evening. We drink in the evening, we drink in the morning. We drink and we drink. We dig a grave in the air. There's room for us all. Paul Celan, 1944. Russia arrived first at the politics of eternity. Kleptocracy made the political virtues of succession, integration, and novelty impossible, and so political fiction had to make them unthinkable. Ivan Ilyin's ideas gave form to the politics of eternity. A Russian nation bathed in the untruth of its own innocence could learn total self-love. Vladimir Surkov showed how eternity could animate modern media. While working for Putin, he wrote and published a novel, Almost Zero, 2009, that was a kind of political confession. In the story, the only truth was our need for lies, the only freedom our acceptance of this verdict. In a story within a larger plot, the hero was troubled by a flatmate who only slept. An expert issued a report. "We will all be gone," the expert confided, as soon as he opens his eyes. Society's duty, and yours in particular, is to continue his dream. The perpetuation of the dream state was Surkov's job description. If the only truth was the absence of truth, the liars were honorable servants of Russia. To end factuality is to begin eternity. If citizens doubt everything, they cannot see alternative models beyond Russia's borders, cannot carry out sensible discussions about reform, and cannot trust one another enough to organize for political change. A plausible future requires a factual present. Following Ilyin, Surkov spoke of the contemplation of the whole, which enabled a vision of geopolitical reality, that foreigners tried to draw Russians away from their native innocence with their regular attacks. Russians were to be loved for their ignorance. Loving them meant perfecting that ignorance. The future held only more ignorance about the more distant future. As he wrote in Almost Zero, knowledge only gives knowledge, but uncertainty gives hope. Like Ilyin before him, Surkov treated Christianity as a gateway to his own superior creation. Surkov's God was a reclusive colleague with limitations, a fellow demiurge to be bucked up with a few manly slaps. As Ilyin had done, Surkov invoked familiar biblical verses in order to invert their meanings. In his novel, he has a nun refer to 1 Corinthians 13:13. Uncertainty gives hope, faith, love. If citizens can be kept uncertain by the regular manufacture of crisis, their emotions can be managed and directed. This is the opposite of the plain meaning of the biblical passage Surkov was citing. Hope, faith, and love are the trinity of virtues that articulate themselves as we learn to see the world as it is. Just before this passage is the famous one about maturity as seen from the vantage of another. For now we see through a glass, darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. The first thing we learn when we see from the perspective of another is that we are not innocent. Surkov meant to keep the glass dark. In the Russia of the 2010s, the dark glass was a television screen. 90% of Russians relied upon television for their news. Surkov was the head of public relations for Pervy Kanal, the country's most important channel, before he became a media manager for Boris Yeltsin and Vladimir Putin. He oversaw the transformation of Russian television from a true plurality representing various interests into a false plurality where images differed, but the message was the same. In the mid-2010s, the state budget of Pervy Kanal was about $850 million a year. Its employees and those of other Russian state networks were taught that power was real, but that the facts of the world were not. Russia's Deputy Minister of Communications, Alexei Volin, described their career path. They're going to work for the man, and the man will tell them what to write, what not to write, and how this or that thing should be written. And the man has the right to do it because he pays them. Factuality was not a constraint. Lev Pavlovsky, a leading political technologist, explained, "You can just say anything. Create realities." International news came to substitute for regional and local news, which all but disappeared from television. Foreign coverage meant the daily registration of the eternal current of Western corruption, hypocrisy, and enmity. Nothing in Europe or America was worthy of emulation. True change was impossible. That was the message. RT, Russia's television propaganda center for foreign audiences, had the same purpose: the suppression of knowledge that might inspire action, and the coaxing of emotion into inaction. It subverted the format of the news broadcast by its straight-faced embrace of Baroque contradiction, inviting a Holocaust denier to speak and identifying him as a human rights activist, hosting a neo-Nazi and referring to him as a specialist on the Middle East. In the words of Vladimir Putin, RT was funded by the government, so it cannot help but reflect the Russian government's official position. That position was the absence of a factual world, and the level of funding was about $400 million a year. Americans and Europeans found in the channel an amplifier of their own doubts, sometimes perfectly justified, in the truthfulness of their own leaders and the vitality of their own media. RT's slogan, "Question More," inspired an appetite for more uncertainty. It made no sense to question the factuality of what RT broadcast, since what it broadcast was the denial of factuality. As its director said, there is no such thing as objective reporting. RT wished to convey that all media lied, but that only RT was honest by not pretending to be truthful. Factuality was replaced by a knowing cynicism that asked nothing of the viewer but the occasional nod before sleep. Information war is now the main type of war. Dmitry Kisilov was in a position to know. He was the coordinator of the Russian State Agency for International News and the host of a popular Sunday evening program, Vesti Nedeli, that led the information offensive against Ukraine. The first men the Kremlin sent to Ukraine, the spearpoint of the Russian invasion, were the political technologists. A war where Surkov commands is fought in unreality. He was in Crimea and Kiev in February 2014 and served as Putin's advisor on Ukraine thereafter. The Russian political technologist, Alexander Borodai, was the press officer for Crimea during its annexation. In summer 2014, the prime ministers of two newly invented People's Republics in Ukraine's southeast were Russian media managers. A modest affair in military terms, the Russian invasion of southern and then southeastern Ukraine involved the most sophisticated propaganda campaign in the history of warfare. The propaganda worked at two levels. First, as a direct assault on factuality, denying the obvious, even the war itself. Second, as an unconditional proclamation of innocence, denying that Russia could be responsible for any wrong. No war was taking place, and it was thoroughly justified. When Russia began its invasion of Ukraine on February 24, 2014, President Putin lied with purpose. On February 28, he claimed, "We have no intention of rattling the saber and sending troops to Crimea." He had already sent troops to Crimea. At the moment he uttered these words, Russian troops had been marching through Ukrainian sovereign territory for 4 days. For that matter, the Night Wolves were in Crimea, following Russian soldiers around in a loud display of revving engines, a media stunt to make the Russian presence unmistakable. Even so, Putin chose to mock reporters who noted the basic facts. On March 4th, he asserted that Russian soldiers were local Ukrainian citizens who had purchased their uniforms at local stores. "Why don't you have a look at the post-Soviet states?" Putin proposed. "There are many uniforms there that are similar. You can go to a store and buy any kind of uniform." Putin was not trying to convince anyone in that post-Soviet world that Russia had not invaded Ukraine. Indeed, he took for granted that Ukrainian leaders would not believe his lie. The provisional Ukrainian government understood that Ukraine was under Russian attack, which is why it pled for an international response rather than reacting with military force. Had leaders in Kyiv believed Putin, they certainly would have ordered resistance. Putin's aim was not to fool Ukrainians, but to create a bond of willing ignorance with Russians, who were meant to understand that Putin was lying, but to believe him anyway. As the reporter Charles Clover put it in his study of Lev Gumilov, "Putin has correctly surmised that lies unite rather than divide Russia's political class. The greater and the more obvious the lie, the more his subjects demonstrate their loyalty by accepting it, and the more they participate in the great sacral mystery of Kremlin power." Putin's direct assault on factuality might be called implausible deniability. By denying what everyone knew, Putin was creating unifying fictions at home and dilemmas in European and American newsrooms. Western journalists are taught to report the facts, and by March 4th, the factual evidence that Russia had invaded Ukraine was overwhelming. Russian and Ukrainian journalists had filmed Russian soldiers marching through Crimea. Ukrainians were already calling Russian special forces "little green men," a joking suggestion that the soldiers in their unmarked uniforms must have come from outer space. The soldiers could not speak Ukrainian. Local Ukrainians were also quick to notice Russian slang particular to Russian cities and not used in Ukraine. As the reporter Ekaterina Sagatskova pointed out, the little green men do not conceal that they are from Russia. Western journalists are also taught to report various interpretations of the facts. The adage that there are two sides to a story makes sense when those who represent each side accept the factuality of the world and interpret the same set of facts. Putin's strategy of implausible deniability exploited this convention while destroying its basis. He positioned himself as a side of the story while mocking factuality. "I am lying to you openly, and we both know it," is not a side of the story. It is a trap. Western editors, although they had the reports of the Russian invasion on their desks in the late days of February and the early days of March 2014, chose to feature Putin's exuberant denials. And so the narrative of the Russian invasion of Ukraine shifted in a subtle but profound way. It was not about what was happening to Ukrainians, but about what the Russian president chose to say about Ukraine. A real war became reality television, with Putin as the hero. Much of the press accepted its supporting role in the drama. Even as Western editors became more critical over time, their criticism was framed as their own doubts about Kremlin claims. When Putin later admitted that Russia had indeed invaded Ukraine, this only proved that the Western press had been a player in his show. After implausible deniability, Russia's second propaganda strategy was the proclamation of innocence. The invasion was to be understood not as a stronger country attacking a weaker neighbor at a moment of extreme vulnerability, but as the righteous rebellion of an oppressed people against an overpowering global conspiracy. As Putin said on March 4th, "I sometimes get the feeling that across the huge puddle, in America, People sit in a lab and conduct experiments, as if with rats, without actually understanding the consequences of what they are doing. The war was not taking place, but were it taking place, America was to be blamed, and since America was a superpower, all was permitted in response to its omnipotent malice. If Russia had invaded, which it was somehow both doing and not doing, Russians would be justified in whatever they were doing and not doing. The choice of tactics in the invasion served this strategy of innocence. The absence of insignia on Russian uniforms and the absence of markings on Russian weapons, armor, equipment, and vehicles did not convince anyone in Ukraine. The point was to create the ambiance of a television drama of heroic locals taking unusual measures against titanic American power. Russians would be expected to believe the preposterous, that the soldiers whom they saw on their television screens were not their own army, but a ragtag band of can-do Ukrainian rebels defending the honor of their people against a Nazi regime supported by infinite American power. The absence of insignia was not meant as evidence, but as a cue about how Russian viewers were supposed to follow the plot. It was not meant to convince in a factual sense, but to guide in a narrative sense. Real soldiers pretending for dramatic reasons to be local partisans can use partisan tactics, thus endangering real civilians. As a tactic of war, this might be called reverse asymmetry. Normally, asymmetrical warfare means the use of unconventional tactics by a partisan force or terrorist group against a stronger regular army. In the Russian invasion, the strong used the weapons of the weak, partisan and terrorist tactics, in order to pretend to be the weak. During what was already an illegal invasion, the Russian army broke the basic laws of war, by design and from the outset. Putin endorsed this manner of warfare even as he denied that a Russian invasion was underway. On March 4th, he predicted that Russian soldiers would hide among civilians. And let's see those Ukrainian troops try to shoot their own people, with us behind them. Not in front, but behind. Let them just try to shoot at women and children. The battle for Crimea was easily won by March 2014. The subsequent Russian intervention in southeastern Ukraine continued. In this second campaign, implausible deniability would again test the fidelity of Russians and the courage of journalists, and reverse asymmetry would again cover an illegal war in the aureole of victimhood. The two tactics confirm the politics of eternity, where facts vanish amidst the insistence that nothing ever happens except foreign malevolence and legitimate resistance. Assisted by Surkov, Putin invited Russians into a cycle of eternity in which Russia was defending itself, as it had always done. Eternity takes certain points from the past and portrays them as moments of righteousness, discarding the time in between. In this war, Russian leaders had already mentioned two such points, the conversion of Volodymyr Valdemar in 988, which supposedly made of Ukraine and Russia a single nation forever, and the German invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941, which somehow made a Ukrainian protest movement a fascist threat. To justify the extended intervention in Ukraine's southeast, Putin in April 2014 added a third reference to the past, 1774. That was when the Russian Empire defeated the Ottoman Empire and the next territories on the north shore of the Black Sea, some of which are now part of Ukraine. These territories were known in the 18th century as Novorossiya, or New Russia. Putin's use of this term set aside the existing Russian and Ukrainian states while shifting the conversation to ancient rights. In the logic of Novorossiya, Ukraine was the aggressor because it included territories that were once called Russian and therefore were eternally Russian. The radical reframing of the issue allowed Russians and observers to forget the banal facts of the present, such as, for example, the fact that Moscow had never once, in the 22 years of the common existence of the Russian Federation and Ukraine, issued a formal complaint about the treatment of Russians in Ukraine. Most citizens of the Russian Federation had not heard of Novorossiya in this sense before March and April 2014, when Surkov and Dugin first propagated it, and then Putin made it policy. The imperial territory of the 18th century was different than the regions defined by Putin and then the Russian media. The 9 Ukrainian districts of Crimea, Donetsk, Luhansk, Kharkiv, Dnipropetrovsk, Zaporizhia, Mykolaiv, Odessa, and Kherson. When understood historically, the term also had implications other than those Putin had in mind. Empress Catherine spoke of